Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jodi Picoult, who reads from and discusses her new book, The Tenth Circle, published by Atria. In the weeks to come, we have Christopher Moore, Jonathan Safran Foer, Anne Lamott, William Haywood Henderson, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore, and thank you for turning your cell phones off. Tonight's guest is a bookseller's dream, an excellent writer who dares to take on contemporary issues, teen suicide, rape, and the love of a family with two daughters, one with leukemia, the other who helps her sustain life with her own bone marrow, and much, much more. Her books are thoughtful and provocative. The Tenth Circle, like the others, will linger in your mind long after you turn the last page. Please join me in giving a warm Tattered Cover welcome to the author of The Tenth Circle, Jodi Picoult.
All right, I thought I'd like the Cherry Creek location, but this is pretty good. So thank you for coming out tonight. It is really nice to be in Denver. I have to admit, it's past my bedtime now because I came here from the East Coast today. So if I fall asleep, one of you guys in the front row, just come and hit me. I'll wake right up. It's great to be out here promoting The Tenth Circle. If you've heard me talk before in Denver, I've probably even mentioned this book because for many years, I wrote it about a year and a half ago, and for many years I've known this is coming, and I've known it's a really good one. And it's really nice to know that my readers are agreeing. This book debuted this weekend at number 2 on the New York Times list, which was great. So thank you all. And I also don't want to tell you very much about it, because I always prefer to have the characters introduce themselves. But I will kind of give you a little history on how I came to write this particular book. I have three kids. They are 10, 12, and 14. Yes, I accept condolences for that one. And, you know, the thing is that now that I have these kids that are becoming adolescents, I always thought that having your kids grow up was a totally organic thing, you know? Like, it just happened. But that's actually not the case. You have to let your kids grow up. There's this active process that you take part in. And it's a really weird process because for your whole life you're told that being a good parent means you've got to take care of your kids, you've got to protect them, you've got to watch over them. And then there's this moment where you're just suddenly supposed to let go because that's what being a good parent is. And sometimes your kid takes a really nasty fall and you're not even allowed to help them back up. Well, that's also usually the same exact moment that a child realizes her parents are not superheroes. And that makes for some very interesting tension. So, you know, when I started to think about this book, I wanted to start it with the what-if questions that were building in my head, because that's how all the books start. And this one had several what-if questions. What if I chose to write the story of a girl who literally has to grow up overnight because of a single act of violence? And what if one of the main characters in this book, in this case, the girl's father, is not a man of words. He can't really tell you anything about how he feels because he's just not good at it. But he is an artist. So in the aftermath of this trauma, the only way that you get to figure out how he's feeling are through pages that look like this. In between the narrative chapters of this book is a graphic novel that has been written and drawn by one of the characters, Daniel Stone. And it tells you a lot about what's going on in his mind at that moment. And what if, most of all, we all had to go through hell in order to figure out what really mattered the most? So that's kind of what was swirling around in my head when I started this book. And you can keep that in the back of your mind as I let Daniel and Trixie Stone introduce themselves. Trixie Stone had been a ghost for 14 days, 7 hours, and 36 minutes, not that she was officially counting. This meant that she walked around school and smiled when she was supposed to. She pretended to listen when the algebra teacher talked about commutative properties. She even sat in the cafeteria with the other ninth graders. But while they laughed at the lunch lady's hairstyles or lack thereof, Trixie studied her hands and wondered whether anyone else noticed that if the sun hit your palm a certain way, you could see right through to the skin, to the busy tunnels with blood moving around inside. Corpuscles. She slipped the word into her mouth and tucked it high against her cheek like a sucking candy, so that if anyone happened to ask her a question, she could just shake her head, unable to speak. Trixie steeled herself to endure the next 48 minutes. Psychology was the only class she had with Jason, who was a junior. It was an elective, which was a fancy way of saying, you asked for this. She could smell him, shampoo and peppermint gum and the cool white mist of ice. It was the same smell on the t-shirt she'd hidden in the bottom of her pajama drawer, the one he didn't know she had, the one she wrapped around her pillow each night before she went to sleep. It kept the details in her dreams, a callus on the edge of Jason's wrist, rubbed raw by his hockey glove. The flannel-covered sound of his voice when she called him on the phone and woke him, the way he twirled a pencil around the fingers of one hand when he was nervous or thinking too hard. He'd been doing that when he broke up with her. When she felt a hand on her shoulder, a warm, broad guy's hand, all the breath left her body. Jason was going to apologize. He'd realized he'd made a mistake. He wanted to ask her if she'd ever forgive him. She turned around, the word yes playing over her lips like the call of a flute, but instead found herself staring at Moss Minton, Jason's best friend. "She's just something he needs to get out of his system," Moss said. Trixie's handwriting started to swim on the page before her. "I'm going to be sick," she managed, and with the classroom wheeling around her, she grabbed her books and fled. In the bathroom, she flung her backpack under the row of square white sinks that looked like a giant's dentures. It wasn't that Jason had broken up with her on their 3-month anniversary. It wasn't that Trixie had lost her Cinderella status. It was that she truly believed you could be 14 when you learned how love could change the speed your blood ran through you. It was that Trixie knew she couldn't have loved Jason this hard if he hadn't loved her that way, too. Trixie took out her compact mirror. It took 3 stomps before the glass inside shattered. She slid down along the tiled wall of the bathroom and dragged the makeshift knife over the white canvas of her inner arm. As soon as she did it, she wished she could take it back. Crazy girls did this, girls who walked like zombies through YA novels. Trixie felt the sting of skin as it split, the sweet welling rise of blood. It hurt, though not as much as everything else. If he had the choice, Daniel would draw a villain every time. There just wasn't all that much you could do with heroes. They came with a set of traditional standards. Square jaw, overdeveloped calves, perfect teeth. They sported ridiculous boots that no one without superhuman strength would be caught dead wearing. On the other hand, your average bad guy might have a face shaped like an onion, an anvil, a pancake. His physique might be meaty or cadaverous, furry or rubberized, covered with lizard scales. He could speak in lightning, throw fire, swallow mountains. A villain let your creativity out of its cage. Problem was, you couldn't have one without the other. There couldn't be a bad guy unless there was a good guy to create the standard, and there couldn't be a good guy until a bad guy showed just how far off the path he might stray. He kept a picture of Trixie over his workspace. Not just because he loved her, but because for this particular graphic novel, The Tenth Circle, she was his inspiration. Well, Trixie and Laura. Laura's obsession with Dante had provided the bare bones of the plot of the story. Trixie had provided the impetus. This September, Trixie had gotten a boyfriend. Daniel had had his share of fantasies, how he'd be casually cleaning a pistol when she was picked up for her first date, how he'd buy a chastity belt on the internet. In none of these scenarios, though, had he ever really considered how the sight of a boy with his hand around his daughter's waist might make him want to run till his lungs burst. And in none of these scenarios had he seen Trixie's face fill with light when the boy came to the door, the same way she'd once looked at him. Not coincidentally, Daniel found himself drawing a new graphic novel about Duncan, an ordinary father whose daughter had been kidnapped by the devil into Dante's circles of hell. When provoked through rage or fear, Duncan would morph into Wildclaw, literally becoming an animal. Daniel had come by this concept, honestly. He'd grown up as the only white boy in a native Alaskan village where his mother was a schoolteacher. In Akiak, the Yupik Eskimos spoke freely of children who went to live with seals, of men who shared a home with black bears. One woman had married a dog and given birth to puppies, only to peel back the fur to see there were actually babies underneath. an animal, was simply a non-human person. You could see it in the way they sat together for meals, or fell in love, or grieved. And this went both ways. Sometimes in a human, there would turn out to be a hidden bit of a beast. Daniel spent most of his childhood waiting to leave. He was a Gussock, a white kid, and this was reason enough to be teased or bullied or beaten. By the time he was Trixie's age, he was getting drunk, damaging property, and making sure the rest of the world knew better than to screw with him. Once Daniel left Akiak, he never looked back. He learned how to stop using his fists, how to put rage on the page instead. He became a typical suburban father who coached soccer, grilled burgers, mowed the lawn, a man you'd never expect had been accused of something so awful he tried to outrun himself. Now Daniel took his mechanical pencil and started sketching his unlikely hero. No spandex, no high boots, no half mask. Like Daniel, Duncan had shaggy dark hair and a dark complexion. Like Daniel, Duncan had a teenage daughter, and like Daniel, everything Duncan did or didn't do was linked to a past that he refused to discuss. When you got right down to it, Daniel was secretly drawing himself. "Good timing," Daniel said as he heard Trixie's footsteps pounding down the stairs. He set two plates on the kitchen table and turned around to find her waiting in her coat, carrying a backpack. "Oh," she said, blinking at the food. "Zephyr invited me for dinner and a sleepover." Daniel had known Zephyr since she was 7. He used to sit in the living room while she and Trixie performed cheerleading moves or lip-synced to the radio. Last week, Daniel had walked in with a bag of groceries to find someone unfamiliar in the kitchen bent over a catalog. Nice ass, he thought, until she straightened and turned out to be Zephyr. She hadn't noticed that he went red in the face or that he left the kitchen before Trixie returned. He sat on the couch with the grocery bag in his hands, the ice cream softening against his chest, as he speculated whether there were other fathers out there making the same mistake when they happened upon Trixie. "I can walk," Trixie said. "It's dark out." "I'm not a baby, Dad." "Yeah, then maybe before you go to Zephyr's, you could go vote, join the army, rent us a car." "Oh, hang on, that's right, you can't." Trixie rolled her eyes, took off her hat and gloves, and sat down. "What are you guys going to do tonight?" Daniel asked. "I don't know. Rent a movie off the dish, I guess. What are you going to do?" "Same thing I always do when I'm alone in the house. Dance around naked, call the psychic hotline, negotiate world peace." Trixie smiled. "Can you clean my room, too?" "Depends on whether the North Koreans are being cooperative." He took a few bites and then dumped the rest into the trash. "All right, you're officially free." She bounced up, heading toward the front door. "Thanks, Daddy." "Anytime," Daniel said, but the words turned up at the end, as if he were asking her for minutes that were no longer hers to give. She wasn't lying. Not any more than her father had when Trixie was little, and he said one day they'd get a dog, although they didn't. She was just telling him what he wanted, needed, to hear. Everyone always said the best relationships between parents and kids involved open communication, but Trixie knew that was a joke. The best relationships were the ones where both sides went out of their way to make sure the other wasn't disappointed. She wasn't lying, not really. She was going to Zephyr's house, and she did plan to sleep over. But Zephyr's mother had gone to visit her older brother at Wesleyan for the weekend, and Trixie wasn't the only one who'd been invited. A bunch of people were coming, including some hockey players. Like Jason. Trixie ducked behind the fence at Mrs. Argabath's house, opened up her backpack, and pulled out the jeans that were so low-rise she had to go commando. She'd bought them a month ago and had hidden them from her father because she knew he'd have a heart attack if he saw her wearing them. Shimmying out of her sweatpants and underwear, jeez, it was cold out, she skimmed on the jeans. She rummaged for the items she'd stolen from her mother's closet, a chain-link belt, a sheer black blouse. She zipped up her coat again, jammed on her hat, and started walking. Trixie honestly wasn't sure she'd be able to do what Zephyr had suggested. "Make him come to you," Zephyr had said. "Get him jealous." Then again, maybe it would be easier than she expected. Being someone else, anyone else, even for one night, would beat being Trixie Stone. Daniel was dreaming of hell. There was a lake of ice and a run of tundra, a dog tied to a steel rod, its nose buried in a dish of fish soup. He heard the hollow thump of a basketball on the slick wooden boardwalk and the tail of a green tarp rattling against the seat of the snow machine it covered. He saw a moon that hung too late in the sky, like a drunk unwilling to leave the best seat at the bar. At the sound of the crash, he came awake immediately to find himself still alone in bed. It was 3:32 a.m. The hardwood floors felt cold beneath his bare feet. By the time he reached the kitchen, he'd nearly convinced himself he was about to come face to face with an intruder. An old wariness rose in him, a muscle memory of fight or flight that he thought he'd long forgotten. In the mudroom, he realized Trixie must have come home early. Her coat was here. Her boots kicked off on the brick floor. "Trixie," he called out, heading upstairs again. But she wasn't in her bedroom, and when he reached the bathroom, the door was locked. He threw his entire weight against the dam until the door burst free. Trixie huddled in the crease made by the wall in the shower stall. "Baby, are you sick?" Her hands were knotted together between them, like a heart that had broken its bounds. "Daddy," she whispered, "he raped me." She had kissed him back. They must have both fallen asleep for a while, because Trixie woke up with him leaning over her. She felt her skin burn where he touched her. She was jerked back to the present as her father reached for the controls of the heater on the dashboard. "Are you too hot?" "It's okay." But it wasn't. Not anymore. Not by a long shot. Daniel fiddled with the knob for another moment. This was the nightmare that sank its teeth into every parent's neck. Your child is hurt. How quickly can you make it better? What if you can't? Daniel heard the name. He couldn't get out of his head. Not since the moment he found Trixie in the bathroom. "Who did this to you?" "Jason. Jason Underhill." In a tornado of pure fury, Daniel had grabbed the first thing he could lay hold of, a soap dish, and hurled it into the bathroom mirror. Trixie had started shrieking, shaking so hard it took him 5 minutes to calm her down. He didn't know who'd been more shocked, Trixie, who'd never seen him like this, or Daniel himself, who'd forgotten. Suddenly, Daniel braked hard. The logging truck in front of them was weaving over the median line of the divided highway. Danger came in different packages at different points in a lifetime. There were grapes and marbles and other choking hazards. There were trees too tall for climbing. There were matches and scooters and kitchen knives left lying on the counter. Daniel had obsessed about the day Trixie would be able to drive. He could teach her to be the most defensive driver on the planet, but he couldn't vouch for the moron truckers who hadn't slept for 3 days. Out the passenger window, Trixie watched the scenery stream by without registering a single image. She couldn't stop wondering, if she hadn't kissed him back, would it never have happened? Jason found that the only time of day his mind was truly occupied was during hockey practice. He simply gave himself over to the game, cutting hard, skating fast, stick handling with surety and grace. It was this simple. If you were giving 100% at hockey, you didn't have room left for anything else, like obsessing over the rumor going around school that Trixie Stone had said she was raped. But now practice was over, and with it came the casual conversation that would inevitably turn to Trixie. Jason hurried off the ice and pulled off the gladiator layers of his equipment. He was the first player out of the rink, the first player to his car. He slid into the driver's seat and turned the ignition, then rested his head on the wheel for a second. "Jesus," he murmured. Jason felt the blade of the knife on his Adam's apple before he heard the voice at his ear. "Close enough," Daniel Stone said. "Start praying." Thank you. See, and you guys all thought your families were dysfunctional, huh? I know that after I do a little light reading like that, I like to play a game called Jody Trivia. Now, for those of you who receive my newsletter, and I would encourage you all to sign up for it on my website, it means that you'll know where I am before my mother does. You know that part of the promotion for the 10th Circle involves a giveaway at every event, and this is what we're giving away. These handy-dandy 10th Circle t-shirts.
Ooh, fancy, huh?
So we have five of these to give away, and the first one I'm going to give away to the person who has actually come the furthest for this event. Now, we've had some insane... Actually, last year I was at the Tatter Cover, and someone drove from Iowa, and he proposed to his girlfriend there. And some of you may remember this, right? I didn't know he'd driven from Iowa. I mean, I thought it was enough he was proposing to his girlfriend. But anyway, I don't know if any of you came from Iowa. But it can't be like, you know, you actually are coming from Seattle because you're on spring break and your mom lives here. It has to be like you came here for this event. So does anyone think they came a really long distance tonight? You all live in the backyard of this store. Yes, where did you come from? What was that? Scotland? You came from further than Scotland?
No. 35 miles, 40 miles.
I may be wrong, but I think Scotland is farther away. So you get this t-shirt. Come on down.
Yes, sure. Thanks.
Yay! Don't tell her, but I'm going to be in Scotland in about 3 weeks. Okay? Now, the rest of you, though, are going to have to work for your T-shirts, okay? And this is all Jody trivia. This was all made up by my mother, so you can blame her. But the answers are all on my website, and I know you've been doing nothing but reading my website, you know, so clearly you have these. I'm going to throw... Now, this is the only rule. If you know the answer, raise your hand. If you call it out, you will be disqualified, okay? So, and I will pick you. I'm going to throw you guys a total softball first. Where did I go to college undergraduate? Yes! Actually, you were not the one I called on! Yes! That's even better. She got the class right, but that's because she was in it, too. But you can win it. Come on down! But you know what? Okay, now the lady who screamed out the answer because she thought I called on her, which was a totally normal mistake, I'm going to give you first crack at the next question, okay? What magazine published my first short story? Do you know it?
17.
Yes! Oh, my gosh! Amazing! I believe we have a stalker. Excellent. Yay! Okay, we have two more T-shirts left. Let's see. Okay, this is a really interesting one, because I'm actually learning that nobody knows the answer to this, and it's giving me great fear for the PR machines in Hollywood. What company has optioned My Sister's Keeper for feature film? Again, raise your hand if you know the answer. Do you know it? Yes?
Lifetime?
No, that's not feature. Yep.
Fox.
Not Fox? Not Miramax? This is what happens. Now we all start guessing. Yep.
HBO.
Not HBO? Nope.
DreamWorks.
Anyone else?
DreamWorks.
Not DreamWorks? Nope. Not Disney? Nope. Yep.
Walden Media?
Not Walden Media. Is there a Walden Media? No. Nope. Way in the back?
Lionsgate?
What was that?
Lionsgate?
Not Lionsgate? Way in the back?
Warner Brothers?
Not Warner. And behind him? Nope.
MGM.
Not MGM. I'm telling you, isn't this sad? Yep. Not Universal? Yep. Nope. Not Fine Line? Way in the back? Nope. Yep. No, isn't this great? Do we know there were this many companies? Yep. What? Nope. Yep. Nope. Okay, I believe you're all going to have to go home and do a little homework now because I'm not telling you the answer. But I think it's really funny because I'm actually headed to L.A. tomorrow and I think I need to call this company and say, guys, you got to get out there more. Nobody knows who you are. All right, so I'm going to make it an easier question for you. Which two books of mine have been made into Lifetime movies?
The Pact and Plain Truth.
Yes! Pact and Plain Truth. Good! All right. Okay, and this is for all those people who already receive my newsletter and read it, I hope, with great abandon when it winds up in your inbox. Who can tell me, and you've got to be pretty specific here, where have I been doing my most recent research this fall? More specific? Huh? More specific? More specific? More specific? Anyone know?
On death row.
Death row. That's it. Yep. Very good. Thank you all for playing. Well, now I hope you guys have some questions to ask me. We have some time before I have to start signing all of your books. So if anyone's got a question, just raise your hand. The only thing I'm going to ask is if you want to talk about the ending of a book, you do it in big, open terms so that we don't give it away for someone who hasn't read it yet, okay? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that. Anyone have a question? Yeah.
What can you tell?
God. You know, I got to say, this question cracks me up. What can I tell you about my next book? I love this because, you know, I worked so hard on this book, and you read it in like 2 nights, and then you're like, well, what's next? But okay, I'll tell you. Actually, I'm happy to tell, especially this community, because I think it's something that will resonate pretty heavily. The next book is about a school shooting in a small New Hampshire town. And is a book about difference and intolerance and bullying, and it's a pretty important topic. It was very interesting and hard emotionally for me to research as a parent, and that's what it's going to be about. And it's done. It's ready to go, and we'll probably be out, I would think, again in March in 2007. Yeah. What's my view on stem cell research? I'm going to tell you guys a story about this first. I was doing an event in Massachusetts, and this woman came up to me after the event. She said, I have read My Sister's Keeper 6 times, and I still don't know your opinion on stem cell research. And I said, well, thank you very much for that, because that's a really big compliment to me. And, you know, I am more than happy to tell you my personal opinion, but I'll also tell you that my opinion should matter the least, because I don't know the answers to the very hard questions that I write about, and I don't think it's my job as a writer to give you the answer. What I think it's my job to do is to get you talking. You may never come to the answer, but I think sometimes hearing the other point of view is a really good place to start a conversation. So with that little disclaimer, you know, I think that I am pro-stem cell research myself, and it was only cemented by meeting the real-life family that actually lives in this area, who were, they were the first ones to conceive a child as a bone marrow match for an older sibling. And they are a great family. Their children are fantastic. When you meet them, you don't think monsters. You think, oh, parents who want their kids to be healthy. And that's something we can all relate to. And I think that the great disservice our country has done is taking stem cell research and making it a catchword for politicians. When we talk about it, it's usually in some political context. And people forget that every single day there are families living this at an emotional and very base and personal level. And when I wrote My Sister's Keeper, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to take you into the hearts and the minds of one family that was dealing with it. You know, ultimately, your opinion will still be your opinion, but it's a lot easier to point a finger and blame someone if you haven't walked a mile in their shoes. Thank you. Anyone else? Yeah.
Where do you get all of your ideas?
Where do my ideas come from? I once heard a writer say that they arrive every Thursday wrapped in brown parcel. Isn't that great? Mine don't, though. But, you know, for me, they usually come from big what-if questions that I can't answer. And it could be something that comes out of a fight I've had with my husband. It could be a newspaper article I've read. It could be my mother calling and saying, hey, this is a really interesting idea. It could be something that my kids bring home from school that they're anxious about. But it's usually something that makes me think, well, what would I do in that situation? Or what's the right answer here? And if I can't answer it, and I'm still thinking about it a couple of weeks later, it's probably a really good idea for a book. And if I'm still thinking about it 3 or 4 weeks later, characters start to pop up like mushrooms. And they just take the story away in a plot. And that's usually the point where I stop and do as much research as I can. And then eventually I go back and I let myself write the whole book. I think that the act of writing for me is like the act of reading for you. Because, like I said, I don't know the answer. And sometimes I don't know it any better when I finish the book than I did when I started. But I have laid out all the different facets of a situation. And even if I haven't changed my opinion, I've really forced myself to answer, why do I have that opinion in the first place? Which of my books is my favorite? I have for many years gone on record as saying Second Glance is my favorite because it was a very different, a difficult book to write, a really different book, one that you don't see very often in fiction in terms of themes and characters. And from a writing standpoint, that makes me really proud. But since The Tenth Circle is out, this book is like nothing you've ever seen, and I am just so fiercely proud of that. Because, you know, when you write fiction, there's this tendency to think that Shakespeare did it all and we just recycle it. And so if you can do something that you really feel is unique and novel, a really novel novel, that's pretty amazing. And so I'm really very proud of this from a writing standpoint. Yeah. Wow, someone's helping me out. I bet I've been there, actually. But, yeah, if you go to my website, there is always a place at the bottom of the page that if you roll the cursor over, you'll see it highlights, and that email goes straight to me. And
No, I'm really serious.
By all means, send it to me. Absolutely. Yep, and most of you who've written to me know I answer my email and everything. So, yep. Yep. When do I write? What's my routine? Well, I have 3 children, That pretty much answers that question, doesn't it? I really write around their schedules, and I used to be way more impressive because I was churning out a novel a year, and I was the stay-at-home parent, and my kids were home from school because they were little. But apparently I've lost my superhuman strength, and now my kids are in school 8 hours a day, so I have this built-in block of time when they go off. My husband takes them to school at 7:30. I go up to my computer. I answer fan mail for about an hour, and then I just pull up whatever I've been writing the day before, edit my way through it, and keep going. And I write usually straight through until about 4 o'clock when I magically turn into a mother again and begin driving to hockey practice. You know, and that's really what my life is like. Nights are for the kids, weekends are for the kids, and, you know, there are times when I'll break that schedule if I'm really close to the end of a book, and they're pretty good about that. But for the most part, I fit my writing in around when they are otherwise occupied. Yes! What about the research process? Well, I'm lucky now in that my husband now has a job that he does out of the house. And so he can be home and he can do his job around my kids' schedules too. And because he is so supportive, really, of what I do, I can go off to the Alaskan bush for a week at a time. I can go to Death Row twice this fall. You know, I can do whatever I need to. And I mean, it's very liberating to leave your house and not even have to leave a single note, because he knows exactly what's going on, and he does it every day. So it's because of him that I can get out of the house and do that stuff. When you're doing research, it's totally different. And when you're on a book tour, totally different. If you can write at all, that's pretty much a miracle. Who did the graphic art for the 10th Circle? This is actually a cool story. When I was in college, first of all, I'll tell you how I got to the graphic novel. When I was writing this book, I knew I wanted to write about the stories we tell ourselves, the lies we tell, but also the way we tell stories, because there are as many different ways to do that as there are stories. And I could have made Daniel a dancer, a classical artist, a songwriter, but because I was including Dante's Inferno and this whole theme of be careful what you wish for, it might come true, and does the punishment fit the sin, it was just tailor-made for a graphic novel. You know, and the whole idea of good and evil fighting in every man just seemed to be exactly what Dante's poem was about. So I decided, all right, Daniel's going to be a graphic novelist. Unfortunately, I had never read one in my life. And luckily, though, I have a 12-year-old son who lives and breathes them. And so I went into Jake and I said, teach me everything you know. So he gave me a crash course on all comic book superheroes. And then I did a little background research. You may not realize that comic books were invented in America by two guys in the 1930s who couldn't get a job as reporters. So they created this guy who was a total loser and still got the girl at the end. And that was Superman. And during the Depression, America really needed someone like that. And so for a long time, all superheroes were good guys in capes. And then in the 1960s, Marvel reinvented the superhero, and they created a guy who didn't want responsibility, didn't want to be a superhero, was moody and surly and nasty, and a lot like the teenagers who were reading him, and that was Spider-Man. And from there, we've had a lot of superheroes who are all different shades of gray. If you read graphic novels now, you'll find superheroes who like inflicting pain and superheroes who never win. And, you know, it's much more different than the cookie-cutter black and white hero that we used to have. And that's why they're so interesting. In this book, it's very hard to see who's a villain and who's a hero, which is exactly the point. So when I started working on this and I knew I was going to be writing a graphic novel, I figured out that my best inroad was someone who did this for a living. And when I was at Princeton, I lived across the hall my freshman year from this guy who was a pre-med major and never seemed to be doing any of his pre-med homework. Instead, he was sitting at a drafting table drawing superheroes. And he went on to become one of the most famous comic book pencilers in the last 20 years, Jim Lee. So I called Jim up and I said, all right, you got to help me out with this. And he put me in touch with this kid, Dustin, who was an apprentice for him. He was just working basically unpaid at his studio, had never had anything published in his life. And he said, you know, see if Dustin will do it for you. So I struck a deal with this 24-year-old kid, and I paid him by the page to create the graphic novel. And I learned that when you write a graphic novel, you do it on screenwriting software, and you send it off to them like a script, and then they visually imagine it. And every few days, I would get these pages in from Dustin, you know, saying, look, here's Duncan as a hawk, or here he is as a gorilla, and what do you think of this devil? And I'd write him back and say, you know, I always thought the devil looked more like Jack Nicholson. And he does in the book. It's great. So it was really, you know, it was really fun for me, because writing is a very solid pursuit. And to be able to collaborate on something was really cool. What was almost even more remarkable was that Dustin had no idea what the book was about. And of course, one of the reasons that Dante's Inferno ties into this is because to Dante, hell is not fire and brimstone. It's a very cold place. And the worse your sin is, the colder you get, until the devil is stuck up to his waist in a lake of ice and he can't free himself. And that's because for Dante, the worst punishment is immobility, not being able to act. And based on what I read to you, I think you would agree that Daniel might agree with that. But I really wanted to create a character who would envision hell as a very cold place. And I figured, well, a kid who grew up in a native Eskimo village surely would. Well, I'm halfway through this graphic novel, and Dustin calls me one day, and he goes, "You know, did you know I grew up in Alaska?" I was like, "Oh, great. Well, then, you know what I want you to draw." So it was just this perfect dovetailing. All these things seemed to fit together. And it was really a fun experience. Yeah. My 14-year-old has not read The Tenth Circle, but my 12-year-old has. Because he was actually reading the comic book as it came out, and he wanted to see what the story was behind it. And to be honest, I really thought Jake was a little young for what was going on in this book. Not in terms of emotional context, he could handle it, because we had talked about what I was writing about, and after we had the dinner conversation with my 10-year-old about what date rape is, honestly, then you could do anything you want. But I never thought this would personally affect Jake. And so when he read the book, he came up to me afterwards and he started telling me about one of the kids on his hockey team who is 12 years old and who has an older brother and who comes in apparently to every practice and regales them with stories of his conquests and what he does with his girlfriend. And he, like I said, he's 12. So it's happening, and we can all pretend it's not, but we're still pretending. I just did this event. I did probably one of the most surreal events of my life in Holland, Michigan recently. And when I was in Holland, Michigan, which is the northernmost Bible Belt town I've ever seen in my life, I was there, and I was speaking to this group of about 700 people, and these women came up to me afterward, and I had been talking about the 10th circle, and three women in a row go, "Well, that's nice, but that doesn't happen in our town." The fourth woman comes up and goes, "Hi, I'm the nurse who works at the clinic for sexually transmitted diseases, and I treat all their kids." That's not to say that every teenager is doing what Trixie does in the 10th circle, but I bet if you ask your kids, "Do you know about this?" they'll say, "Yeah." So, yeah. When I write legal scenes, not all my books have court scenes in them, but many of them do. And that's because if I write a trial into the book, it's because I found something out that is so stupid about the American legal system that I feel the need to tell all of you about it. So, for example, in the pack, the book that you were talking about, I had learned that I would never be called to testify against my husband in a court of law, but I would be called to testify against my own son. Who would you be more willing to put away, right? And so... So I wanted to create a fictional situation where Gus has to do that. She has to get on the stand and either perjure herself or incriminate her own child. When I do court scenes or anything legal, I treat it exactly like I would any other research. It is like being told that a third of your book has to be written in Greek, so you find someone who's a native speaker of Greek. And I will go to court. I work with judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, you name it. I have them kind of all in my back pocket now, which will probably help me one day. They all know when I'm writing a book, and they're all very happy to help me. Yeah. What am I reading now? I actually just finished a great book. It's called Maybe a Miracle by Brian Strauss, and it's a first novel that no one's heard of, and because it's a first novel, and it was pitch perfect. It is. It reminded me a little of my book Keeping Faith, which is why I picked it up in the first place. But the main character is an adolescent male whose voice is fabulous, and he just nailed it. He did a great job with this book. And he actually, he wrote me because he heard that I had talked about his book, and he thanked me, and then he told me that the book was banned in Columbus, Ohio, and he is so proud of that. So, good for him. And I actually just started a book that you can't get yet. It's, do you remember The Dogs of Babel by Carolyn Parkhurst? She has a new book coming out in June called Lost and Found, and I was given the galley to see if I would blurb it. And I just started that on the plane today. And so far, it's very entertaining. Yeah. Do I write my endings first? I have written, in the 15 years I've been doing this, I have written one scene out of the order in which you read it. Even like in the pact when I go then and now, or in My Sister's Keeper when I do all those different narratives, I write it exactly the way you see it in the book. What I do, though, know is where the ending's going. Because for me, it's my job to leave you this paper trail so after you finish, you can go, oh, how did I not see that coming? You know, and then go back and find it. And in order for me to be able to do that, I need to be able to see how I'm going to weave it through. What changes for me, though, is how I get from the beginning to the end. The characters just take it away, and I kind of hang on for the ride. One more question. You get to be it. You know, there are a lot of working moms in our community, too. I mean, the interesting thing about where I live in Hanover, New Hampshire, so it's where Dartmouth is. And it's a really nice, quiet community. If I was ever given a house key, I don't know where it is. You know, it's just a great place to raise your kids. But it's also the kind of place where you can actually recognize people on the street and people honk at you, you know, when you drive by, which is nice. It's a small town. And every now and then, something will happen that always surprises me. Someone I don't know will come up to me at the elementary school and will say, you know, oh, I loved your book. I read your book this over break and it was great. And I'm like, oh, thanks. That's really nice. Or the little girl who runs the popcorn booth at our local theater has, you know, My Sister's Keeper hidden underneath the popcorn. She's like, I was hoping you'd come when you sign it. You know, and that, to be honest, that freaks my husband out a little bit. But you know, it's really nice because people tend to be very polite. It's not like, you know, people are following you down the street, although I did once find people rooting through our garage sale stuff because they'd heard that's where I live, which was a little freaky. But you know, it's a pretty gentle fandom, which is really very, very nice. Then you also get some jerks. There was a woman, actually, it was when I was doing research for My Sister's Keeper, and I was researching firefighting. And, you know, I was out with the firemen. It was Saturday night, and I had all my turnout gear on. We get a fire. We're downstairs. We're in the truck. We're headed out. And I'm listening to the address, which is patched up through dispatch, and I'm thinking, God, that sounds so familiar. You know, and it turned out to be the home of the child who was the biggest bully in my son's fifth grade class. And so we get there, and everyone gets out of the truck, and I'm thinking, oh, just let it burn, you know? And the guys didn't. They grabbed the hoses and stuff. But the mom is out there in the middle of the snow with all the kids and her husband and, you know, in her pajamas. And she looks at me, and she goes, Jody, you're a fireman? And I was like, no. You know, I explained what I was doing, and she didn't even know I was a writer. And then she came up to me, like, a few weeks later after a vacation. She grabs my sleeve, and she goes, hey, I read one of your books, and guess what? You actually were pretty good. So I went home and I told my son that that's why her son's a bully, you know? But for the most part, it's very interesting, and a lot of people don't make the connection either because my husband's last name is my kid's last name. I write under my maiden name. Although, this is a great story, too, and I'll end with this. My son, Jake, went on a Jody Pico kick last year and decided to read a whole bunch of my books. And so he was in the cafeteria, which he shared as a middle school kid with the high schoolers. And he happened to be reading Perfect Match. And he was reading it, and this girl comes running up to him, apparently a very pretty girl who was a high school girl. And she goes, oh, she is my favorite author. How did you hear about her? And so Jake goes, that's my mom. Well, thank you all for coming out tonight. Please keep reading. Thank you, Charlie.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Christopher Moore, Jonathan Safran Foer, Anne Lamott, William Haywood Henderson, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on March 27th, 2006.